The Inside Ellen Road podcast is sponsored by PR Supplies at Unit 2 Wither Park Industrial Estate, Leeds, postcode LS53AP. Check out PR Supplies on Facebook for all your home retail needs. Hello, welcome back to the Inside Ellen Road podcast. After a minor blip, which Daniel Farker wouldn't quite call a blip, such as the value of a point on the road in this league, Leeds are back to winning ways. A 1-1 draw at Huddersfield was followed by a 1-0 win over Stoke at Ellen Road, which means Leeds remain in the hunt for automatic promotion with just 10 games remaining this season. As ever, I'm your host, Joe Donoghue, joined by the YEP's chief football writer, Graham Smith. Graham, you remarked after the game on Tuesday night that Leeds looked knackered but still managed to get the job done, which I imagine is something you identify with quite strongly.
Yes, I saw a lot of myself in the physical inability to celebrate. You know, it's just those small wins where all you have left is just like a slight fist pump or a nod of the head. Yeah, they looked out on their feet to me on Tuesday night, and I don't know how I worried to be, because there is an international break coming up, so some of them will get a rest. And sometimes, you know, for the others, a change is as good as a rest. But that game seems to take an awful lot out of them. And they just looked done, absolutely done. Invested a lot in that game. And I thought did enough to win it, certainly, but could easily have drawn it.
Yeah, it's important that they did get the win, because I think, while there was a little bit of mild consternation that Leeds had failed to beat Huddersfield, you know, struggling at the bottom, threatened by relegation at the weekend, I think there was an overriding sense of, okay, well, it's one game. Like, these things happen sometimes, especially in the circumstances of, you know, 22 minutes ball in play during the first half and, you know, time wasting that you wouldn't believe in the second. I think if Leeds had drawn, or God forbid lost against Stoke in midweek, then it would have been a few people headed to the panic stations and you know, just slamming the big red button saying abort season. But yeah, I think the team are still very much on an even keel. They're tipping upwards, and yeah, they might be a bit tired, but I think after this Sheffield Wednesday game, which obviously coming this Friday, it's massive. After that, there is a little bit of respite, and the international break does have the facility to offer a mental break as well as a physical break.
Yeah.
Unless you're Welsh or Finnish, of course.
Yeah, but even so, I don't know. It's part of me that thinks that international breaks still might offer a bit more rest and recovery than, I know there's travel involved, but a bit more rest and recovery than, you know, playing four games in 10 days, three games in 6 days. The Huddersfield game, I don't think you can be too mad at the fact that Leeds didn't win it, because they have 31 points from 33. And had they beaten Huddersfield but drawn against Leicester at Elland Road, nobody would be complaining at all. Exactly. Nobody would complain. 31 points from 33 is remarkable. When you think of how far away Leeds were after West Brom, and you look at how close they are to Leicester now, I mean, it's a title race now. That's what it is. That's remarkable. I mean, that form has been remarkable. And yet, it needed something like that. I remember before Christmas, we were saying, do Leeds need to match this form of Leicester and Ipswich, you know, to get anywhere near them? And we actually, I think the position we arrived in was actually, no, they need to be better than them for a long stretch. And they have been, because they've narrowed those gaps. That's a mathematical fact, Joseph. So I don't think you can be too angry at the Huddersfield result. I think you can be angry at how the game went, because it was a frustrating, horrible, horrible day. But the result, fine. A point on the road, fine. And actually, I'd take one on Friday night.
Interesting you'd say that. We'll get on to the Sheffield Wednesday predictions and you know, the preview for that game towards the end of this week's podcast. But I think it's probably best to go back to the beginning. We haven't spoke to everybody since that Huddersfield game, or before the Huddersfield game. So let's take a trip down memory lane to John Smith Stadium. A wet and dreary Saturday morning arrived. You decided that you'd go straight for the food, and there was, I don't know, what was it, like leftover onion bargee or something?
No,
wasn't quite my topic for, you know, 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning. But hey, you know, when a man is hungry, a man is hungry. What happened after that?
I went too early, but I have to say I was misled entirely. I was led down the garden path by Baron Cross of Leeds Live, who was already tucking into an onion bargee and reliably informed me upon entry to the press room that the breakfast burrito was being made, but it wouldn't be there for an hour or so. And I thought to myself, well, I haven't had my banana omelet this morning for breakfast. I deliberately didn't have breakfast because I thought, well, I can eat at the ground. And I was hungry. So I thought, that onion bargee looks really nice, you know, like fresh salad-y mush and whatnot. It looked decent. And you know what? It was decent. It was really, really lovely. It wasn't leftover. But then, just as I was finishing the final bites, in comes the breakfast burrito. And I mean, you can inform the listeners and the viewers as to what exactly that entailed, but it looked sensational.
Well, 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 listener, let me tell you, it was as filling and as voluminous as it was delicious. It was a Yorkshire pudding burrito breakfast wrap. Fair play to Huddersfield Town. You know
what else? There's a lot else in that box.
Oh, I'm not finished. There was a Scotch egg. It was a gourmet Scotch egg. There was a pot of beans.
Black pudding Scotch egg.
Yes. Yeah, there was a pot of beans.
Couple of beans.
All of this was very, very hot, by the way. And what else was there? There was something.
Is there some chicken or something?
No, I'm not sure it was chicken.
Yeah, see, food is wasted on you. You can't even describe it.
No.
What you do is you have a mug of beans and you dip a sausage in it. That's what you do.
That's what it was. It was like sausage and bacon as well.
That's
and then
incredible.
There was the breakfast burrito on top, and oh, it was fantastic. You know, we're obviously big fans of the press food on this podcast. I think it's probably the biggest press food revelations that you get on this podcast, certainly from a Leeds United perspective. But it was excellent, and it was made all the better by just sort of looking to my right, kind of looking up from the big box of food that was in front of me, grateful that it had been so generously provided by Huddersfield Town Football Club, and looking to my right and seeing that you had just about finished your onion bargee, and that was a really sweet moment. It was like looking at Bruce Bogtrotter from the Matilda, with instead of chocolate cake around his mouth, it was sort of, you know, a little bit of, I don't know, mango chutney in his beard. If Bruce had a beard, and just going, oh, I tell you what, Graham, this is excellent. It's also, I think it's dairy free as well. So yeah, that was a great start to the day. It's a shame that the football didn't live up to it, but you know, you can't have everything, can you?
Yeah. The football was like eating a bowl of sick, cold sick at that. Someone else's cold sick.
Yeah, that's what the first half was like. It was miserable. Anyone who was there will know exactly what we're on about. Anyone who watched it on telly, fair play if you made it through the 90 minutes. Honestly, the best part of the first half was, because of the number of stoppages and the number of injuries, was just how keen the stretcher bearers were from St. John's Ambulance. We're talking every single time a player went down, they were up, they were on their feet, they were at the touchline, ready to come on for even the most like innocuous of kicks. I honestly think that Huddersfield have got their St. John's Ambulance people on a per injury payment basis. So I think that needs to be investigated. But that was quite funny. They were so keen.
Yeah, they really were. And they showed a lot more urgency than Huddersfield did, you know, to get about their business. Because Huddersfield were determined to play as little football as humanly possible in that game. And I think we have to lay some of the blame at Leeds' feet as well, because Leeds were not good in possession for parts of that game. They were slow and sluggish, I thought. There's been times recently where I've thought Melier, his distribution needs to be a bit quicker. He needs to make a decision a bit sooner. I know that at times he's trying to draw the centre forward in so that he can pass it left or right, bypass them, and then the defender has a bit more space in which to play. There's other times, though, when I feel like he hangs on to it and there's an opportunity to get the ball away and beyond the first line of the press. We have enjoyed this season how patient Leeds have been in settling things down and playing out from the back. But what I didn't enjoy so much, I thought Grave and Kamara didn't retain the ball as well as I would have liked. I don't think that Grave was enough of a factor. And I thought Kamara was wasteful in possession. I don't think he looked after the ball anywhere near as well as he can. And I also think that, did we talk about Pirou's kind of speed of thought and speed of movement not quite being up to scratch at Chelsea? It was a little bit like that with Grave and Kamara, that there were times where they got the ball and I thought to myself, turn out and play that forward, or, you know, there's a pass on there, but they went backwards, and that kind of ruined an opportunity to play through. But I do accept Farke's point that with so many interruptions, it was impossible to get into a rhythm. And there were a lot of injury interruptions and a lot of fouls. And some of the fouls were ridiculous. I mean, it probably should have, well, no, not probably. For me, it should have been two red cards in the first half. Because the Pearson one on Somerville, VAR picks that up and gives a red card, I think, because it's a deliberate studs up challenge on the back of a player's leg. It's reckless. Could have done a lot of damage. And then he had the cheek to look angry when he got booked for it.
I feel like you can always tell by a player's reaction, and the slow-mo of that Pearson challenge, he rakes his studs down the back of Somerville's calf, and immediately sort of looks in the direction of the referee, puts both hands in the air, and sort of goes, "What? Are you sure about that? No, I haven't touched him. He's gone down like a sack of spuds there." That's a telltale sign. I think at the top level, some of the play act, the innocence pleading is you know, similar to a level of the, you know, your Kevin De Bruyne's, their quality. But at the lower levels, it's very much closer to Sunday League, you know, didn't touch him, ref, got the ball.
Yeah. It's more Amdram than Oscars, isn't it?
It is. Great analogy.
Yeah.
I was going down a dark alley there, but you swept in and saved me like Spider-Man.
I would say, yeah, it's more more beast in players than it would be, I don't know, Channel 4 or BBC. I didn't enjoy that challenge. I didn't enjoy Jonathan Hogg's performance. You could argue that he should have had two yellow cards for the one challenge where he tried to injure, he tried to stop Jorginho Rutter by any means necessary with a kind of wraparound tackle, and he also managed to injure Nakayama from his own team at exactly the same time with the same challenge. Referee might have seen that as two injuries and two fouls and yellow carded him twice, but he stayed on, and then he made sure that he didn't stay on any longer when he took a good look to see where Junior Firpo was and then led with his elbow. Mindless, absolutely mindless. I don't want ever to be a podcast that we paint the opposition as the bad guys and it becomes a bit of a pantomime where everything they do is evil and Leeds can do no wrong, because we can get on to some of Leeds United's reaction to the physicality, which I really wasn't impressed with. But I just thought that was so dumb. Like, so for a captain to do that, so incredibly dumb. And he quite rightly, he probably could have been red carded for that alone. So off he popped, waved off by Ethan Ampadu.
Which I think was one of the shining lights of that day, that game.
Yeah, very few highlights on that day. So,
God, can you imagine if Conor Roberts had been on the pitch? That would have been excellent.
Yeah, he'd have had a lot to say, wouldn't he? What I didn't like so much in the aftermath, I could see that Bamford was maybe trying to give a little bit back, but he left one in on someone, didn't he? It wasn't quite Ben Thatcher on Mendes, but. If Ben Thatcher on Mendes was a 10, Bamford's was probably a 1 or a 2, but it was in the same kind of idea, you know, just leaving one late on a defender as he clears the ball. That isn't the way. When you're Leeds United and you have the ability and quality that you have, that breaking up the game even more isn't the way to respond to it. And Willy Nyonto, I think, was probably the biggest culprit. There was a bit of head loss with him, I think. You know, he gave away a free kick in a really dangerous position, needless, you know, barge in the back. One of those where you think, don't foul. And the player almost inevitably then goes into the back of the opposition and gives away a free kick. And from that free kick, Leeds defend it really poorly. I think Pearson got up above Ampadu, and then nobody reacted to Melier's save. And suddenly, Huddersfield are in front. And then you've just given yourself, even if they've got 10 men, and you've got a half left to play, and you've given yourself a really difficult challenge there. And I thought that Nyonto's response, if you want to call it that, carried on in the second half. You know, there was a moment where he went down clutching his face as if he'd been caught, and there was nothing in it at all, just nothing. And the kind of, I feel like the histrionics just weren't needed. I don't think that helped Leeds' cause either. I think Leeds needed to play their football and just play their football and play it left to right and just exhaust Huddersfield. And then eventually they'd get their moment or two. And they probably should have won it, shouldn't they? Like, when you think about the chances, I mean, Huddersfield had a couple of chances too, but did Leeds do enough to win that? I mean, evidently not, but could they have won it? Arguably so.
Maybe I'm looking at it through the lens of how positive and how good the performances have been recently, but I didn't think there were enough clear-cut chances to say that, yeah, they really deserve to win that. I thought that the performance and the game plan that Huddersfield carried out was effective. They set out to do that. They set out to frustrate Leeds. They were able to do that from start to finish. And yeah, I think a draw was a fair result, if I'm being honest. And you're going to have off days. You know, in a championship run-in, you're going to have off days. I mean, you said something in the in your verdict that, you know, it was after the Stoke game that they, in the Marcelo Bielsa promotion season, you know, they won quite a lot of games 1-0 when they were sort of, they were just plucking away. They maybe weren't blowing teams out of the water, but they were getting the job done just thereabouts. I think it was a similar, well, I think we're in a similar sort of position now.
Yeah, I still have in my mind the Jorginho Rutter header from a corner, a free header. He needs to get that on target. And Somerville hitting the post with his trademark effort. I mean, he was not at it. And maybe that's got something to do with the fact that he was kicked from pillar to post in the first half. Maybe that had an impact. We know that he's had some injury issues this season. Some muscle strains and calf issues and all kinds of things that he's kind of worked through. I just think he's in a little bit of a dip at the minute in terms of form. He's maybe taken a few touches too many before he lets the shot go, or he makes a decision, or he tries to find a teammate. In ice hockey, they call it, you know, they say that players are clutching the stick a bit too tightly whenever they get into a goal-scoring position because they're thinking about it too much. And you wonder if there's maybe an element of that with Somerville, but again, he came really close, didn't he? He came very, very close.
Yeah, he did. But I imagine that he'll come good again. I think especially after the international break, there's a window there for him because he's not gonna. I mean, you'd imagine he probably won't go away with the Dutch team, because that would be a first call up for him, and that would be magnificent for him personally. But I think for Leeds' promotion bid, it's definitely better that he stays put at Thorpe Arch and just gets a bit of a rest. I think, yeah, he's just it's very easy to say, oh, he's probably feeling the effects of, you know, being kicked around all season. Like, yeah, fair enough. He's probably been kicked every week, sometimes twice a week, multiple times for, you know, 6-7 months straight now. And he's still got, what, 16, 17 goals? I think he's earned a few sort of off nights or off days, because he is someone who has that game-changing ability. We've seen it, you know, even when he's having a bit of an off day, Farker prefers to have him still on the pitch. Same as Jorginho Rutter. You know, if he's maybe not at his best, he can still do what he did against Stoke on Tuesday night and, you know, drop deep, take the ball down, shrug off his man, and then thread a nice ball through for someone in a more advanced position. Somerville's the same. You saw when he came on against Plymouth, straight away he was, you know, getting into his office, as you say, and, you know, cutting across the face of the box and rifling shots with his right foot from sort of the left-hand side. I think it's not something that anyone's really too worried about, or at least not that I've seen. I think it's just par for the course of a 46-game season. Your star man is probably going to have a little bit of a blip at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Rafinha having blips as well, and he, I think everyone would probably concur, he's among the very, very elite for Leeds United in the last, goodness knows how many years, when it comes to ability and form. The other thing you could say is that Leeds United's attacking options have generally covered for each other's weaknesses this season. They've covered for each other's dips in form. You know, when Willy Nyonto and Patrick Bamford couldn't buy a goal or an assist when they were coming off the bench, Pirou was scoring, Somerville was scoring, Dan James was scoring. Dan James was out the team for a while there. Pirou's kind of hit the skids a little bit. Bamford starts popping up with goals. Nyonto scored a few goals in a row. And then again, at the weekend, Somerville doesn't get the goal. Dan James comes off the bench and provides it for Patrick Bamford. So when you spread goals across your team like that, it means that when your talisman is out, the whole thing doesn't grind to a halt, doesn't fall apart. I would look at Sunderland and Jack Clarke being out at the minute, and that would worry me as a Sunderland fan, because he's been really talismanic for them this season. I think with Leeds, it's a slightly different story because of the quality they've got up front, quality that most teams in this division just don't have in such abundance. You know, Jadon Anthony has been out for the last two games, and when he's back in, he's another option who can make things happen. He certainly made something happen at Chelsea last week. And then you've got Matteo Joseph, who's building a little bit of momentum now after what's probably been a season of patience for him. You know, he's really needed to be patient. It's been little cameos here and there after an injury. He'd be further ahead than he is now had it not been for that injury. He'd have played a lot more, I think. But he really took his chance at Chelsea. He looked very good to me against Stoke. And so he's now put himself in that conversation as a genuine goal-scoring threat that you can bring on. And I think Pirou will come good with a few goals still this season. I don't know what it is with him. I don't know how, whether his goals masked it at the start of the season or whether he's just going through a really rough spell. It's almost like now we don't know what he is. You know, we don't know that he's a nine because he doesn't really play like one, doesn't play like Bamford does, doesn't play like Joseph would do as a nine. He's not really a 10 either because he doesn't do what Jorginho Rutter does. He's not quick enough in the head or in the feet to do what Jorginho Rutter does. So it's like we've arrived at a position towards the end of the season where we're thinking, what actually is Joel Pirou? I know we've had this whole 9.5 thing, but you think, well, where does he fit into this system and continue to score goals? At the same time, he's in double figures for the season. So, you know, he's not a bad man to have around. If the ball is to be played back to the edge of the box, in and around that area, he's not a bad man at all to be running onto it. And I think he'll probably still chip in with a couple of goals. So, yeah, if Somerville's off it for a little bit, then you expect someone else to step up and Leeds have the players to do that.
I just want to go back to Matteo Joseph in particular, because his breakthrough has been one of the more positive aspects of the last couple of weeks, when maybe it's been a little bit testing, you know, losing against Chelsea and then the game against Stoke, which was, you know, nerve-wracking at times and tiring and, you know, wearisome. But Joseph has really injected some life into the team, basically, hasn't he? Still very young, still just 20 years old. Comes across as really humble and really grateful for the opportunity. And, you know, he's had to work his way to get there. I mean, I remember his debut for the 21s was away at Blackburn, I think. It was definitely at the Lancashire FA. I remember him coming on, you know, fresh from signing from Espanyol. I honestly remember at the time thinking, what must he be thinking? He's, you know, come off the bench in place of Max Dean, and he's playing on an awful pitch. but his pressing was really spot on. He was only on for about 10 minutes, but you could see there was some real zip to his game there. Since then, he's really filled out. He's shot up, and he's, I don't know, he looks like a professional footballer now. You know, he looks like someone who can hold his own against senior defenders. I think this season, initially, obviously, it was you know, had to be patient, as you said. The game when he came on Boxing Day against Preston, I personally thought he showed glimpses there that he's, you know, someone who's going to work really hard for the team. Other people disagreed. Maybe their viewpoints had been clouded by the result. And then you've also got the run out from the start against Plymouth in the Cup, which again, I think we both sat there and thought he's given a really good account of himself there. He's certainly done himself no harm in terms of being considered a senior option. And then obviously the Chelsea game, takes his goals really well, then comes off the bench against Stoke and is really, really bright. And what Daniel Farke was saying in his press conference ahead of the Sheffield Wednesday game was, you know, along the lines of he is going to get more and more minutes if he continues to do stuff like that. And that's exactly what you need to be hearing as a young player, because you can't underestimate how difficult it is to make an impact off the bench in 10, 15 minute cameos and the one or two starts that you get in the cup and very different circumstances again in a team that is, you know, much changed. To do that is really, really impressive. Because you've not got the rhythm of playing with certain teammates. You've not got the innate knowledge of, okay, he's going to pass there, I'm going to make this run and he's going to find me, that we've seen with Jorginho Rutter and Crescencio Somerville, for example. So I really think that there's a player there that Leeds can utilize. And if we're talking about Joel Pirro as well, if you're looking at this system that Leeds play, I think Joseph certainly suits the number nine role theoretically, or at least on paper, a little bit better than Pirro does, even though Pirro obviously has vastly more minutes and you know, double figures for goals. I quite like the, you know, Joseph can play on the shoulder, can run the channels, but he can also hold it up and really, you know, give as good as he's getting from a centre half. I just think it's really beneficial for him and beneficial for Leeds. And yeah, really, really wanted him to score that first Elland Road goal against Stoke when it was cleared off the line. And that takes me on just very briefly. It's a little segue here, but tweet of the week. I actually might take me a little while to find this, so I might need your help here, Graham.
That's right. I can fill in for a minute. I don't like to do this very often at all, and I can feel the bile rising in the back of my throat as I even think about saying it. But you were very consistent last season in saying that Joseph was the one. You know, lots of people were very, very keen on Sonny Perkins, and he was very, very highly rated. And you were very, very consistent saying that actually, no, Joseph is the one from those two. You tipped him to make the impact first, and he has done, you know, and he's won that little mini battle, if you like, because Sonny Perkins had to go out on loan, didn't get any minutes because for whatever reason, but there were question marks over his application in training that Daniel Farke put there before the loan. And then Perkins has come back and he's having to play with the 21s, while Joseph is now, as you said, looking more and more like a men's game player, you know, looking more muscular, looking more physical. He's what I really liked in the Stoke performance was he fought to get through onto that. Was it an Ampadu long ball?
Yes.
I think it probably was. It had all the hallmarks of an Ampadu long ball. In fact, when I watched it back, it was Ampadu, because Ampadu looked to play it the first time. It wasn't quite on. I think he passed it to Rodon and got it back, or he passed it to someone and got it back. And this time it was on and he looked up and he played it and it was perfect. You know, just another one of those great balls over the top. But Joseph had to really fight to get free of his marker. You know, he had to physically free himself from a defender's clutches. Then his pace took him onto the ball. I thought he was really composed to take it round the keeper, and he just got unlucky, you know, that the defender managed to get back and clear it. He just didn't quite catch the finish enough.
And I think there are other strikers in this squad who maybe wouldn't have had the opportunity to go around the goalkeeper, because they wouldn't have got to that point
No.
in the sort of the move, in the sequence.
And then the other chance, you know, he really made for himself with that. He made a good run off the ball. James found him. The pass wasn't ideal, but the way that Joseph nipped back inside round the defender to send him the wrong way and then curled it, you really wanted to see that just clip the post and nestle in the net, but it really wasn't very far away. And I think he's taken the step towards what we wanted to see, because you and I, when we spoke about him before, we said he's looking to win free kicks, looking to win throw-ins, looking to hold the ball up, looking to annoy defenders. But he's not really got any chances. He's not really had a chance to make a goal-scoring impact, and that's what a striker wants. He's now finding himself with chances. You think of Plymouth away. He hit the post, didn't he, at Plymouth away?
Yeah.
He had another one saved. He put another one wide, I think. But he was getting in positions, making chances for himself, and also getting on the end of things. Chelsea got on the end of things quite brilliantly. I really, really like what we're seeing from him and his trajectory. And maybe we can come on to talk about Friday night and the team selection. But there's definitely a conversation to be had there about how many minutes he gets on Friday.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're at the point now where we're sort of almost assuming that he is going to get minutes. But thank you for sort of covering for me there, because I have found Tweet of the Week, and it's in reply to you, Graham. It's in reply to that chance where Joseph takes it around the goalkeeper. You said, chance, oh my, Joseph fights to get in behind onto a long pass. Funny, you didn't mention it was Ampadu, so can't think that your eyesight will have been that good at the time. Breaks free, goes past Iverson and shoots from an acute angle. Good word use. Wilmot arrives to clear off the line. And my favourite reply of the week was by Echo LUFC, who said very simply, who has that much effort playing for Stoke? Which I think is... Honestly, fair enough.
Absolute sweat.
Yeah, why try hard? What, trying to stop a goal? You're trying to rob a goal from a child?
Ooh, well done, he's 13.
I've actually met and interviewed Ben Wilmot, and he's actually a really nice lad, so I don't want
to... Was he the lad... Did he come from Cheltenham or Stevenage or something?
He was at Stevenage, went to Watford, obviously went on loan to Udinese, and then ended up at... I think he went to Swansea, and now he's at Stoke.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great bit of defending, actually. You know, that's the solace that Joseph should take, is that he was denied by a great bit of defending. Shall we
be denied on Friday night? I feel like a SmackDown versus Raw announcer.
We should talk about Stoke before we talk about Wednesday, really, ideally.
Yes, that is definitely the primary topic.
Go on then.
I thought you were sort of gearing yourself up to go and talk about
you're Stoke. The host, as you keep telling me and telling everyone, you're the host.
Yeah, well, you just have to keep hammering it in until, you know, you don't think it's funny to be insubordinate anymore. What else did we like from the Stoke game? Well, the fact that we now know firsthand that it's Ilya Gruev, Johan Gruev. No, it's Ilya Gruev. After you spoke to him at full time, there was the Connor Roberts show, which you were very keen to include in this week's show notes. Where would you like to start?
Start with the team. Roberts coming in to form that, and James to form that kind of Welsh L between the defence and the right wing, a line of three across the back of them, and then James ahead of them. I thought they were the key men for Leeds in that win. I mean, let's be honest, it was another pig of a game. You know, the parts of the first half when Routier started to get on the ball and do his stuff, and Leeds were pretty on top, pretty dominant. They scored in that period, but they didn't make it comfortable, make it safe. And then the second half was just attritional. You know, Stoke started to play, which made me think, why did you wait? You know, why did you wait this long to start playing? And they made some chances. They forced Melier to make some saves. And they might have considered themselves unlucky not to draw that game. But Rodon and Ampadu, their defending gave me a great deal of satisfaction. I would not call it either of them a head-it-kick-it defender. But when it comes time to make a tackle, make a clearance, win an aerial battle, that they seem to relish it, you know. And the way Rodon's going about his defensive business at the minute, when you see a player chasing a through ball and Rodon is with him or after him, it's almost like a safety blanket descends on Elland Road. Like, everybody just feels fine because Rodon's there and you know what's going to happen. He's been very, very consistent in that regard. Connor Roberts was a big factor with his mouth. I thought he could have performed a bit better on the ball, second half in particular. First half, I thought he linked up with James pretty well, got up and down really well. But he was in the ear of the officials. He was in the ear of opposition players. Pretty much all the Welshmen should have got an assist for the red card for Ben Pearson, who absolutely loves a red card against Leeds. When he came on, I was sat next to Johnny Buckin of BBC Leeds, and when he came on, I said words to the effect of, "Oh, here he comes to kick all around him," and that's exactly what he does. But hit them again, a little bit like Hogg. His yellow cards were wild, like just wild yellow cards to take for a relegation threatened team. The first one for kicking the ball away after James has been fouled. So Ampadu wins it. James takes it on and earns a free kick. He's dragged to the ground in his own half. Pearson steams in and wellies the ball in James's direction. I think it nicks him. And then that brings Rodon in for a confrontation. What Leeds did in that scenario is they made enough of a scene that the yellow card had to come out for Pearson for kicking the ball away. It wasn't one of those where the referee could just ignore it, because Leeds made such a fuss. You know, Connor Roberts was straight in with his mouth. Rodon was straight in to shoulder barge and go chest to chest with Pearson. And Pearson's head went. It just went completely. And after that, a red card was an inevitability. And the fact that he got it for blocking James, you know, he tried to take James out off the ball, because Ampadu was running forward. And again, all the Welshmen were there with a few words for him. James had stuff to say. Roberts made sure that he gave him a fond farewell. And that played a massive part, because I actually thought with Pearson on the pitch, Stoke looked better than they did in the first half, and they were playing more football. And it was a substitution that was working for them until Pearson took himself out of the equation.
Yeah, I think it's something like he's got 6 career red cards and 3 of them have been against Leeds, which is a remarkable record. Someone needs to ask him that once he retires. You know, has a real sit-down interview with him. Just go, what is it about Leeds? Like, do you really hate them that much? I just think he just wasn't thinking. And to be honest, that second yellow, on another day, a referee doesn't spot it and he gets away with it. How many times do you reckon he's done that before?
Yeah, good question.
Also, maybe I'm making this up. Did he ever play for Bournemouth? Because
he played for Preston, didn't he?
He did play for Bournemouth.
And if he didn't play for Preston, then he will, because he is absolutely, he's got Preston written all over him.
Well, he did play for Preston for 5 years. So
there you go. That's why he's got it written all over him.
Hang on, I think maybe we're onto something here. Benjamin David Pearson, born 4th of January 1995, place of birth Oldham. Okay, so that's first. Youth career.
Oh, hang on a minute.
Youth career, 2004 to 2014, Manchester United. Interesting.
Yeah. And he played for Barnsley.
He did play for Barnsley, yeah.
And Preston aren't fond of Leeds either. I mean, I know most people are not fond of Leeds if you're not Leeds, but
we've got to the bottom of it.
Yeah, we've solved him. We've solved Ben Pearson's anger. Maybe I'll not be so angry now that we've solved him. He was a Rubik's cube, but we've sorted him out.
I think if, considering he's 29, he's coming off the bench for Stoke in the Championship. If Leeds are going one way, and if they are going up this season, I think that could be the last opportunity he has to get sent,
Against Leeds. Yeah. He saw his moment.
Yeah.
He had, what's her name? Martine McCutcheon, this is my moment, ringing in his ears as Dan James ran through to try and support Ampadu. That helped Leeds, I think. It didn't solve the second half, because Stoke still piled on the pressure, and there was that chance for Kevin Campbell's lad, Tyrese, skinned Ampadu. brought a save from Melier. And then who was it had the shot, the final kick of the game? It was
Josh Laurent.
Yes, Josh Laurent, who tested Melier earlier with a long-range one. If he catches that on the edge of the box, I actually thought, as he shaped, I was like, my mind was thinking, this is a goal. Because he just...
No, what were you really thinking? I'm sorry, having worked with you for a good number of years now, I know the way your mind works. Your mind did not say to you, oh, this is a goal. What? Go on, what was it really? We'll tick the explicit ticker.
Don't try and peer pressure me into swearing. This isn't the first or second year of secondary school. Yes, you are correct. My mind went to four-letter words. Exclusively four-letter words, because it looked to me like their moment had arrived, Stoke. But again, you know, Leeds gutted that one out. And like you said earlier, I did point out in my verdict that Bielsa's team at this stage, this exact stage of the season, won three games 1-0 in a row. And Johnny Buchan, again, he said to me, this game feels like the Barnsley game where Leeds 1-0. And it was, that game was a mess. I don't know if you remember, but Bielsa swapped Berardi's position about seven times in the space of 2 minutes in that game. And Luke Ayling was absolutely doing his nut. And he came off at halftime, like, shaking his head furiously, and was caught on camera saying, what the F are we doing? And it was not a good performance. And Leeds won that game 1-0. And at the end, there wasn't big celebrations, but Liam Cooper just looked to the heavens and roared, and then kind of collapsed onto Ben White or Berra or whoever was, I think it was Ben White, because they knew how big a win that was. Mm. And although in that game, Leeds were practically there. They knew if they won that Barnsley game, they were essentially there for promotion. It doesn't feel like that yet for Leeds, but it certainly felt at full time that Farke and his players knew this was big for us to win this game, because we were not good in the second half, and yet we still managed to win it 1-0. We still didn't concede a huge amount of XG, and they didn't concede a goal again for the umpteenth time this season. You just got to keep ticking them off. And there's two ways of doing it. Like, you could go the Ipswich way, you know, the Kevin Keegan side of the Championship, who are scoring last-minute goals and having drama aplenty, and they're getting it done that way.
Keep this positive, yep.
Or you can do it the Leeds way, which is, at the minute, grinding out results, controlling teams, not conceding goals. So, you know, pick your poison. I don't think fans of either Ipswich or Leeds were particularly comfortable until full time on Tuesday night, but you can't argue with the result, another result, and 31 points from 33. It almost at this stage doesn't matter how they come.
It just matters that they do.
Exactly.
Well, pick your poison, that's a good way of describing it, because it has felt increasingly lately, with Ipswich winning six on the bounce, it honestly feels like death taxes and Ipswich somehow finding a late winner from somewhere. And yeah, full credit to them, obviously working or operating on a different budget to many of the other teams at the top. Also, you know, they have nothing to lose. You know, if they ultimately fall short this season, it's not the end of the world. Financially, it's not the end of the world with their fans. They'll still be, you know, championed as heroes. But it honestly looks as though they're going all the way. They added really well in January. Kiefer Moore coming in, Ali Alhamadi. I think they got Lewis Travis and Jeremy Sarmiento as well. They added really well. And that could be the difference between, you know, them ultimately holding off a challenge from a Leeds or a Southampton for the rest of the season. But yeah, they won 3-2 against Bristol City, despite going behind twice on Tuesday night.
And missing a penalty last
minute. And missing a penalty, yeah. Leif Davis redeeming himself for that horror show at Elland Road earlier this season with two assists and a goal, the winner, no less. And Leicester winning 1-0 at the Stadium of Light over Sunderland. So it was basically the top three was as you were, you know, we'll just keep winning. So it probably wasn't ideal for Russell Martin and Southampton when the warehouse adjacent to St Mary's Stadium on Wednesday morning went up in flames and meant that they're now having two games that they need to reschedule before the end of the season in midweek. So, you know, added fixture congestion at the wrong time of the season. They will have been well and truly prepared for that Preston game. That's now gone out the window. They'll have to play that, I don't know, a Tuesday or Wednesday night within the next 2 months. Yeah, it was, it's probably not ideal for them considering they're now 6 points off Leeds, eight off the automatics and 11 off top spot.
Yeah, it's probably the time when they should have called in the old firefighter, Sam Allardyce, wasn't it, to put out that fire. Could have seen Joe Aribo up a ladder with a bucket if they really wanted to get the game on. But thankfully, no one was injured in that. It did look absolutely horrific. And there was only really one decision that could be made, wasn't there? Because you cannot have thousands of people coming into an area where there's a great big blazing inferno. And it'll be interesting to see how they
go for a fact, though. You absolutely know for a fine fact there'll have been someone of a certain age who would have described it or decried it as health and safety gone mad. But just because the actual stadium itself wasn't on fire, why can't they just play it?
I'm not on fire. I'm not on fire. I can go to the game. Yeah, somebody's dad on Facebook saying, in my day, we'd have played that. I think if you saw the pictures and the videos, I think everyone was just relieved that there wasn't, you know, severe injuries and or worse from that, because it looked absolutely awful and so close to the stadium as well. But interesting to see how they cope with that. The top four have been pretty spectacular this season, haven't they? You know, each of them has done something really impressive. You know, Southampton went on that ridiculous run. Leeds are still in what I think is a ridiculous run. 10 wins from 11 and the 11th being a draw. Leicester were just a machine for so long. And Ipswich, the context is what makes Ipswich's season so good as a newly promoted team. But they're not the only teams that have put together an impressive run since the bleak midwinter. Sheffield Wednesday. Somebody told me that if the league had started after they drew with Leicester, which might have been November, they'd be in the playoff positions, something like that. Something crazy. Oh, they've won 10 of 8. They've won 10 of 18.
That is good.
And they were down. Like, they were absolutely down. When we saw them earlier in the season, even though they got a point at Elland Road, I thought to myself, they have got absolutely nothing going for them. Like, they are going to lose a lot of games and they might draw some games, but they're not going to win very many. They're not going to score very many goals. And, you know, obviously live in Sheffield and speak to a lot of Sheffield Wednesday fans during the week, and they were all convinced that they were down as well.
Early on as that in the season?
Yeah. Yeah, they were convinced, as convinced as Rotherham fans have been for about the same length of time. And then, you know, new manager comes in and just, he's transformed them. And it shows how badly they started the season, that they're still in it. You know, despite that remarkable turnaround, but the fact that they're still relegation threatened. I mean, I think personally, of the teams down there, they've got one of the better chances of staying up. No, I think they've got the bit between their teeth.
Just on what you said there, since they drew with Leicester, that's around 18 games ago. Looking here with the table of the last 20, Sheffield Wednesday are eighth.
Yeah.
And then the table of the last 15 games, they're also eighth, but they're joint on 25 points with Norwich, who are sixth. So they are. They're a playoff chasing team. If you begin the season in December, which is, again, not the type of team that you want to be coming up to face when maybe you're a little bit fatigued in Leeds' case. But again, you know, you look at the numbers, you know, Leeds have conceded 7 goals in 15 games. They've conceded 3 in 11. Like, no one wants to play Leeds right now, even if they are a bit tired, just because they're in that muscle memory of, right, we're just going to set up in the same way that we do every week and we're just not going to give an inch. And they haven't. So
I tell you who.
Go on.
I'll tell you who wants to play Leeds.
Who?
Jan Poveda.
Yeah, but he can't, though, can he?
No, he can't.
He's not allowed.
And whose fault is that?
That is Jan Pavela's fault.
It's his own fault. He could have played Leeds if he'd gone on a permanent. But, you know, for reasons known to himself, he wanted that to be alone. He's been a revelation for them. They rave about him. Absolutely rave about him. He's played as a 10. And though he hasn't got, you know, the goals and assists that would make you think that's why they're raving about him, it's the way he gets them up the pitch and the skill level he has that he's been showing. I think he's essentially been doing what he did in that cameo against Forest in pre-season. You know, we were all like, wow, Jan Poveda is a player. And then we didn't really see it very many times after that. Yeah, he's been doing that for Sheffield Wednesday. So that is a big, big blow for them that he can't play. I don't think there's like a natural fit that will come in and do what there isn't anyone who will come in and do exactly what he's been doing in that squad. So it'll have to be something different. But it certainly is good news for Leeds that, you know, essentially one of their form players cannot play because you own him. So, yeah, big, big, big blow for them. But I still expect it to be a very, very difficult game for Leeds. And the energy levels will be interesting. That'll be something to look out for in the first half. And then as the game drags on, you know, how are the legs looking in midfield? How's Routier's legs looking? The wingers. And
like footballers' legs.
Like footballers' legs, yeah. And how will Wednesday play? Because I don't expect them to play like a team in their position against a team in Leeds' position. I think they'll try and play a bit at home in front of that big crowd. I don't think they'd accept the kind of performance that Huddersfield put in against Leeds of all teams.
Okay, then predictions for Friday night.
I'd take a 1-1 draw.
Take a draw on the road in this league. It's always a valuable result.
That's right, Daniel.
I wouldn't.
Oh.
I think you need, because I'm looking at the other fixtures. So you've got, obviously, Leeds playing Sheffield Wednesday this weekend. I also think it's an opportunity playing on Friday night, you know, psychologically to say, right, okay, we've won. Go on Ipswich. Go on, Leicester. Do it. You've got to do it as well. Leicester are away at Hull. Hull beat Leicester earlier this season, and I've been really, really impressed with them. Tigers.
They've got the bit between their teeth as well, haven't they?
Mm-hmm. And then who have Ipswich got? Ipswich have got Cardiff away, and Cardiff are on a bit of a run themselves. 3 wins on the bounce. 2 clean sheets in the last 2. Sorry, 3 clean sheets in the last 4. So 2 informed teams meeting there. It's a weekend for standing up and being counted.
Just looking at the table, who would you want to play against right now? Like, it feels like Leeds have had 3 less than ideal opponents in a row. It feels like those teams you just talked about are teams that you don't particularly want to come up against right now, particularly away. Who, maybe Watford?
Honestly,
you know, Watford.
Sunderland to Watford, so it's 3 teams. Sunderland, yeah. Borough, Watford.
Sunderland,
because everyone else, there's something riding on it.
Yeah. And Sunderland look like they've gone, haven't they? From the playoff race. Have they lost 5 in a row?
Yes, I believe it's 5 in a row, almost 6 if they don't beat Southampton this weekend.
Almost 6, yeah, not quite. And Borough, they're on a slide. People are not happy up there with what's going on after a pretty good start. Yeah, it's crazy. And it's crazy tight too, because Borough could genuinely get sucked in. I mean, well, maybe not. Maybe 47 points, but Bristol City, 44 points. You know, they're only 6 points clear of Stoke. If I was Sheffield Wednesday, I'd really like my chances, because there's a lot of teams down there that could yet go. QPR have won a few recently, but Birmingham, Huddersfield, Millwall, Blackburn, and they've hit the skids as well. So. Yeah, it'll be very interesting the way the season finishes at both ends of the table. But yeah, Wednesday's not a team that you'd choose to play, particularly right now, not at home. Friday night, Yorkshire Derby. The place will be absolutely heaving, I would imagine. They'll be protesting against Chancery.
I just think this is a very Jesse Marsh comment, but you know, this is a game for men. You know, this is a weekend for men.
For fine young, fantastic young men.
Like this is a real opportunity for the players to go, you know what? Yeah, we've been knackered recently, but we have more quality than this team. That's not up for debate. And if they do win, you know, you go up into second. And who's to say that, you know, Ipswich conceding all the goals that they have been, you know, they just maybe don't get that seventh win in a row, that elusive late winner. Because their goal difference is massively inferior to Leeds. So it's basically an extra point.
Here's a question for you then.
Interesting. Role reversal.
You're we'll raving sexist, raving misogynist. So you said it's a game for men, right? So does that mean that you're putting experience over youth in positions where that's possible? Does that mean, therefore, Bamford starts ahead of Joseph, that Connor Roberts starts ahead of Gray, that James starts ahead of Nyonto? What are you saying?
I'd have James starting ahead of Nyonto. I would have Bamford starting ahead of Joseph. And good question on Archie Gray. Can't remember what his game was like against Sheffield Wednesday earlier this season. But again, I don't really know too much about them. So who he'd be going up individually if he was in midfield or at right back. I think with the atmosphere and everything, how it's going to be a really difficult game, I think I'd prefer to have Connor Roberts in there, but then you've also got the option to bring Archie on in central midfield.
I'd bring him in central midfield, personally.
That's what I mean. Like you have the option to sort of start him there.
I'd start him instead of
Glenn Kamara?
Yes.
Are you feeling okay?
I think Kamara in the first half against Stoke was good. I didn't like his performance so much in the second half. I certainly didn't like his performance at Huddersfield. Maybe just needs a bit of a rest.
Okay. I support you in that.
And Roberts, you know, give him a chance to get up a little bit of a momentum, bit of rhythm. He's got a very attacking profile. He likes to get up and down, play him and James together. See what happens. I don't think there should be any fear about playing. I don't think Farker would have any fear of putting Gray into midfield. We know that he trusts him explicitly because he played him at right back for so long and he's not a right back. But we saw what he did against Chelsea and I'd like to see a bit more of that. So, I'd have Gruev as the deep lion one and I'd let Archie have a bit more license, go box to box. And try and pull the strings a little bit. I felt like Leeds missed in the last two games. Leeds missed a bit more forward thinking, a bit more dribbling ability, almost in the middle of the park. They missed a player who, when he got the ball with his back to goal on the halfway line, wouldn't necessarily have to go backwards. You know that he would be able to turn or dribble past someone or find somebody forward. And I think Gray maybe has that in his locker slightly better than Kamara.
Okay, yeah, I'm happy with that. I would be in support of that. Before we finish, just want to address this. Your verdict after the Stoke game was gladiatorial. It was themed on Russell Crowe's The Gladiator, because he announced that he was a minority investor in the 49ers group, which was something we didn't know previously. Obviously, he's had his links to the club in the past. You know, being the voiceover for the Take Us Home documentary and whatnot, and being a celebrity fan. But you were tipped off that there is a member of the Leeds United squad who has a full back piece tattoo of a gladiator from that film.
Yeah, Joe Rodon. I think he showed it on his podcast appearance with the club, the club's official podcast. Which in turn led Michael Bridges to claim that Rodon has nothing going on between his ears, which I find absolutely scandalous. He's got a full tattoo for the entirety of his back of a scene from Gladiator, and it's quite striking. There is an image of it floating around on social media. But I didn't realize that until after I'd written the piece. I wish I had known that, because then I could have referenced it in the intro. It would have made it for an even stronger intro, I think. But yeah, I quite like that we keep finding out about investors and who the investors are, just because they'll like respond to a tweet or they'll out themselves somehow on Instagram. And it's all coming out kind of little bit by bit, isn't it? This cast of millions, billions.
It's like they wanted to have been found out, and that, I don't know, just, you know, journalists, for example, haven't gone and done the digging to find out. So they're having to out themselves now.
Well, I mean, I was just going to email the entirety of Hollywood, just do a blanket, an email bomb. Are you an investor? Reply if so. But I wonder who the most high profile so far unidentified investor might be.
Wouldn't it be hilarious if it was like Sam Allardyce through a shell company invested with the 49ers? You know, he'd reinvested the 500K that he earned for the however many days work that he did at the back end of last season and just put it straight back into 49ers. With a fake name. That would be
just sat, you know, there enjoying Leeds promotion race with a pint of wine.
Absolutely. Allardyce Enterprises.
Brilliant.
Right, enough of that. We're getting way off topic. That is everything this week on the Inside Elland Road podcast. We'll be back next week before the Millwall game, I believe, after the result at Sheffield Wednesday on Friday night. Yeah, if you're going, stay safe. Safe travels down there. Remember to behave yourselves. So, this has been the Inside Elland Road podcast with myself, Joe Donoghue, and the YIP's chief football writer, Glenn Smith. Bye for now.
The Inside Elland Road podcast is sponsored by PR Supplies at Unit 2 Wither Park Industrial Estate in Leeds. PR Supplies, everything for the home.